The show goes on.
The show goes on. Okay, all right. My name's Roger Blumford. I'm one of the three organizers of the Black Hole Astrophysics program here, along with Jean-Pierre Lesota and Doug. And I picked the short straw and have to sort of provide some accounting of what we've been doing. I'm told that David Gross will want his money back if I don't pass this this test. My experience of these this sort of presentation in the past is that there tend to be a lot of questions. I think under the circumstances that would be good. I have quite a lot of sort of view graphs here electronically, many more than I would intend to show, and I've sort of tried to gear my presentation or talk toward not towards the members of the program, who don't know what they're doing anyway, but and are beyond hope, but maybe to the people from the quantum gravity and the local permanent people in Santa Barbara. In as a consequence, I have almost no equations. When you talk to astronomers, you don't, by and large, put a lot of equations because they get bored by equations. When you talk to theoretical physicists, you don't show equations because you're embarrassed by them. And so I have no, almost no equations. But if pushed, I will write some down on a blackboard just to try to make you feel that we sort of are distant cousins from what you do for a living. Okay, a progress report, I call this. Let me just give some sort of statistics. This program began with a workshop that I think was quite successful. I'll say a little bit more about it from February the 2nd to the 5th. We certainly enjoyed it very much, and it gave us a lot to think about. And we also stuck onto that a teacher's forum at the end, which also was a sort of innovation for the ITP. In addition, during our program, although we can take neither the credit nor the blame for the organization for this, there was a gamma ray burst workshop. As I'm sure many people are aware, the phenomenon of gamma ray bursts is believed by many to be associated with black holes and therefore sort of fair game for us. And so as a result, we took a lot of interest in the gamma ray burst workshop and contributed to it and so on. So it really was in some sense part of the program. Now the actual program ourselves, one thing that we've done that sort of worked out quite well is for the sort of sociology of this group, it isn't necessarily appropriate for every group, but I think it sort of helped us a lot, is that we've got people up in the morning. That's a bit of a challenge to come for coffee. So we generally met for an hour or so every morning and talked about nothing in particular, nothing scheduled, just depending on who's present and so on. And this has actually been quite good for all of us. I've certainly learned an awful lot from the sort of casual discussions that I've had there, and I know a lot of research projects have been begun under these circumstances. In addition, we've had two sort of semi-formal talks per week, in the sense that they were not completely extemporized. They were a little better than this, but not a lot. And then the other thing is that there's a sort of quantum gravity program. I think with the singular exception of Jim Bardeen, I don't think anybody in us has contributed substantively to the quantum gravity program, but several of us have been appreciative of having it here and have enjoyed listening to it and tried to sort of glean a little bit of what is going on in these exciting areas.
Yeah, I should point out that quantum gravity is only half of this program. Right? The other half was
classical relativity and so on. Yes. I should correct that. Of course, that's correct. And so you know, now certainly we've been, for a reason I'll come on to, our views of relativity are slightly more pedestrian and prosaic than yours, but nonetheless, what I wanted to say was it's actually been very good for us in being able to sit in on some of these talks, and I personally, and I think several others have enjoyed having that opportunity here at a time when we're not scurrying around trying to do lots of other things. I suppose I could, you know, give lots of other metrics, like how much coffee we've drunk and how many Italian meals we've had, but perhaps one metric that I think is interesting, and this is not sort of saying it's particularly about this program, but I think it's sort of significant for these programs in general, is a lot of this stuff has gone onto the web, for better or for worse, and it is sort of producing a sort of larger college in many respects. And I've invented a new unit called the Kilo Hit. And according to Doug, we're sort of the actual workshop produce 10 to the fifth hits. Now, hits is not actually the number of people. They can be people with nervous dispositions. One person can produce an awful lot of hits, but and you know, if they play too much Space Invaders or whatever, but they but nonetheless, it's clear that there is a much larger community that is, I won't say paying attention, but at least deriving some light relief from the talks and so on. The teachers, well, obviously this is a different community, but the workshop has had sort of quite a lot of people sort of getting the biographs and sort of listening to the audio of the talks, and also the program as well has had quite a bit. So I think, for better or for worse, this is the way this business is going. Okay, now so, yeah, I'm going to say a little bit about the scientific context here, and this is, again, I'm directing this towards the very much towards the non-program participants. Observationally, black holes exist, and that is to say, beyond all reasonable doubt, they are common both in within our galaxy. There's perhaps about 10 black hole binaries. Maybe if I can figure out how to do this, I will leap forward. I think there has to be a better way of doing this. I'm not actually completely. I'm going to go back to that, but I want to go forward. So I want to go. Okay, here you are. Here are 10 black hole binaries. So here's sort of an observational table, and these are the sort of best cases. There are many more of them where the observational evidence is not as good. But here, so there should be a cube. There's a thing called the mass function, which is what Kepler's laws, dynamics is the one sure test of finding a black hole, and Kepler's laws tell us essentially this combination, and then if you know the mass of the companion star or some astrophysics, some trigonometry or whatever, then you can get the masses of the hole. And what we're talking about here is a list of hole masses measured with varying degrees of precision, but all more than this 2.5 or 3 solar masses, which is the maximum mass of a non-black hole compact object, subject to sort of fairly general assumptions. And so so there really is no reasonable alternative, and indeed added to this a lot of circumstantial evidence that one is dealing with something that sort of looks like and quacks like a black hole, and so for all intents and purposes we can regard it as one. Let me just go down to the next one. This is just one example out of many for the extragalactic case, probably the showcase. This is the water maser Kepler lines again. This has now actually gone up with the result of slightly better measurements of 39 million solar masses. These are the larger black holes in the galactic nuclei. Again, so we're dealing with something unusual for ITP that actually has a sort of existence that no. I didn't say that, sorry. So let's just go back there. Okay. So at any rate, so that's one place where we're sort of starting from. And then secondly, when I say the physics of black holes is a solved problem, let me be clear what I mean about that. What I mean is for us, we are interested only in the prosaic aspects of general relativity as applied to black holes, that is to say, the Kerr metric. We believe and we trust that we don't get tangled up with A twiddles M, as Jim would, you know, for very good reason, because most these astrophysical black holes are almost certainly not at that exact limit. We're dealing with A comfortably less than M, but probably comfortably greater than zero too. We're not interested in charge. Astrophysically, it's just a non-starter, because as soon as you've got a little bit of charge, it discharges very, very quickly, so it's not no gravitational importance. We've got this stage set. We trust the Kerr metric. There's been almost no activity in sense of dealing with alternatives to general relativity, except as we regard as an important goal to eventually provide demonstrations, or indeed verifications, that general relativity is the correct theory of strong field gravity, and that I'll come to in a moment. Anyway, so in that sense, if you like, the stage is set by all the hard work done by relativists, including him, in the sort of 60s and early 70s, and now we're sort of trying to see, if you like, the astrophysical plays that are performed on this stage. Now, in some sense, the hot problems here, and this sort of, in some sense, selects the people who've been participating in this program, can be thought of as now, at this point, almost phenomenological. So, or two types of things anyway. One is sort of I'm going to call phenomenological, and basically what's happened is over the last 5 years, I'd say there has been a large increase in the quality and the quantity of astronomical observations of black hole systems. And in particular, the measurement of masses, which I showed you some examples of, has become a much more quantitative business. So we're now sort of doing quantitative physics rather than sort of qualitatively doing things in a scale-free way in the hope that one day it will fit. So that, in some sense, is one reason for this. The other side of this coin is the next 5 years should be even better, because we've got three X-ray telescopes that should be launched within the next 6 months. And in addition, there are a variety of other observational initiatives which will come of age. And so I think there's a strong optimism in this field that the quality of the observational diagnostics will improve. It's just like, you know, anticipating switching on a new accelerator. So it's, you know, there's some excitement about that. So in this sense, this is sort of strongly phenomenological. A lot of people who've been participating in this program are unashamedly phenomenological. Sorry, excuse me. The other sort of way I think about this is a sort of more traditional approach, but one that is as important as ever, and that is the sort of astrophysical approach. And this is, how do they work? It's a little bit like, you know, a geophysicist trying to figure out what's inside the Earth or how earthquakes work and so on. So it's a sort of the cosmic engineering. How do the black hole systems, how do they function? How do they produce jets and X-ray emission and all the rest of it? So I'm not going to go through, you know, all this phenomenology. I'm just saying that this is very much where we're coming from, and it's more or less dictated the sort of the style of the program.
Yes. So,
very good question, Ali. At the moment, there are one or two claims of actually measuring the spin of the hole, and these basically come from the shape of the ion line profile in nearby sort of semi-active galaxies. And by getting the shape of the line profile, you can see how much Doppler shift and gravitational redshift there is. And then with the help of some theory, you can see where the disk is and roughly what the angular velocity has to be. In the one best case, the claim value is near to maximal. Okay, so it was a hole that's spinning nearly as fast as it can be. Now, when I say... Sorry? Well, in this case... we actually don't know the mass of the hole. All we know is A over M, or omega M, however you want to cast it. We don't actually know the mass of the hole in that case. All we know is the, you know, how many gravitational radii the gas is coming from. And I'm being cautious about that because I think most of us are very impressed that it's been possible to do these observations with existing satellites. It's a truly remarkable accomplishment. But we also know other ways of getting the same answer from a slowly spinning hole. And so we're sort of cautious that this is a true measurement, but there's great optimism for these next three X-ray telescopes, which in some sense in combination will be telling us a lot more about the interior flows around black holes. And so I will be very disappointed if we can't do a lot better in 2 years' time. I won't promise you anything because it could be horribly messy. Sometimes astronomy is like that, but there's a strong optimism that it will get a lot better in 2 years' time. And that's the sort of second parameter as far as we're concerned, and that has a lot to do with the astrophysics of what's observed. So, okay, in terms of sort of methodology, I think there are sort of three things that are going on, and they're complementary. And, you know, and part of the, you know, the importance of having these copies and so on is that people with different perspectives are talking to one another a lot more. The three sort of approaches, if you like, are one is the sort of issues of principle, and there you sort of try and make a model. And so this is an oversimplified view of what's going on. So it's like doing, when you know, we know what weather's like, but people have done their 19-level Richardson atmospheres forever and ever, and that's the sort of model of the atmosphere, and they learn a lot from doing that. They don't understand, they can't predict whether it's going to rain in 2 weeks' time, but they can learn an awful lot about the behaviour of our atmosphere from that. And we have our analogues here. So this is, in some sense, addressing issues of physics principle, usually classical physics principle. In this business, it's the 19th century physics that causes us all the heartache. The quantum mechanics and the relativity of the 20th century is not a problem. We know that and we trust that and we believe that. It's not our issue. It's the 19th century stuff that causes us, keeps us awake at night. So in some sense, what you try to do is to make a simple astrophysical model and then address the issue of principle. And once you've understood the issue of principle, then that is important. The second stage is which is numerical experimentation, which is becoming a very much larger part of this program of astrophysics in general, is solving the problems numerically that you can't even start to address analytically, and I'll show you a couple of examples of that. And then finally, interpreting the observations and the data analysis. This is the phenomenological side. You know, and you have this nice, sort of nice, pretty model and so on, and then it's fairly clear what you'd expect to see in the X-ray emission, and somebody goes off and measures it, and it's totally different. So, in some sense, there has to be a feedback there, and it's the same sort of self-referencing or self-checking part of science that we're all familiar with. That sometimes things come out exactly right, sometimes things come out horribly wrong, and then you go back and sort of rework the modelling and so on. So that's the sort of process that's going on. Let me just into the fray episode. So this is produced, I should say, not specially for this audience, but by Kevin Rausch. But he gave me the show. And this is just to make this point. I should have shown this earlier. It's not such a big deal. But it's very nice. This was done obviously for public relations purposes. Well, there is actually a scientific reason for doing this, which I won't explain. These are some movies that were made, and these were just a simple model of an accretion disk as viewed. In this case, you'll see looking at accretion disk where you change the inclination and the spin. And Kevin sort of made these movies and dozens of other ones like that. He just put in four spots around the disk like this. And so this is a sort of, you know, a sort of show and tell thing, and this is what you would see as you change the inclination. Now he's going to change the spin of the hole, all right, from A of A from 0 to close to M. It's probably fairly obvious to you what's going on. You're getting bending of light over the top of the hole and so on there, and you can see the gravitational redshift and blue shift and so on. So now we're going down again. But the point I want to make is that this is the stage. This sort of stagecraft is, I mean, it's not easy, but I mean, it's in principle, it's straightforward. The problem is understanding what the disk really looks like. That's the issue. Okay, but once you know that, you can do the rest of it. You can do the rest of the calculation, sort of turn getting a good graduate student or whatever, and turning the handle. I think there's another one of these. I think. Okay.
So is that made just using geodesics in Kern?
That's just tracing geodesics in Kern. It's not a... How are we doing? Okay, I'll show this one. Okay. This one actually has another point to it, so I should... That's right. That one should go now. That's right. Okay, there you go. So this is another one of the same. You know, and there's other things that, you know, like this, that one can do without any problem. So this is actually following something that's in firing into the black hole. And again, it's a sort of check on your intuition that you sort of know what's going on in the Kerr space-time. If you just stare at this for a while and see what's going on. This is the radius in units of m, and so we're now at about 3.5. This is, I think, a fairly rapidly spinning hole, so you're getting quite close. He's a very kind person, so he stops it just before you get to the horizon. We didn't want to frighten anybody. But this is what you would, you know, this is something what you see. I know you would. Yes. The computer crashed at that point. Okay. Nothing should happen, of course, as you cross the. But we lost contact with it. Okay. So what are we doing? We're doing page down. Okay. Now, eight questions. This is sort of like the 95 theses. When we had our workshop that we kicked this off, we sort of organized things around eight questions. And I'm just going to I'm not going to go through all of these or grade us on how well we did on these, but this, in some sense, all of these questions have been ones we've been sort of interested in the program, and in some sense they're sort of hottish issues at the moment. So one is a sort of one where we try and help the observers. How do we measure masses and angular frequencies, or equivalently angular momenta? That's something that's obviously, you know, the thing that one wants to measure before you start doing any astrophysics at some level. And there's been big progress on M, a tiny bit of progress on Omega, but we'd like to be able to do this in a much better way. So there's been quite a bit of discussion of that, particularly the Omega. Now there's a problem I will say a bit more about, and this is an issue that's really rather hot at the moment, is inflow. We know that black holes have disks around them. We can actually see them in some circumstances. The gas spirals in. It is becoming clear that not all of that gas need get right to the black hole. Much of it can be lost before it gets to the black hole. And this has been a sort of point of debate to which I will return as to how important that is and how this is going on. It's a sort of matter of modelling and calculation at the moment, but I'll show you some of that. Okay, next thing is, what you can see, particularly in the active galactic nuclei, much more easily are the outer parts of the accretion disks. So you can see gas orbiting the black hole at large distances, at large radii. Having those images then sort of challenges one to determine the physical conditions. And so this is a straight astrophysics problem. Having got those images, how can we then infer what the densities, temperatures, speeds, and so on, indeed interior matters, are in these disks? So that was, again, something I think in the program we paid less attention to that than we might have done. Okay, another big question is, as you know, many of these black hole systems, both within our galaxy and in the nuclei of other galaxies, exhibit powerful bidirectional jets that are formed by them. We'd love to know how they are powered and how they are collimated. One hypothesis is it's the energy associated with the spin of the black hole that provides the power for those jets. Another hypothesis is it comes purely from the energy released by the accreting gas. That's a fundamental question. We don't have a completely convincing answer to that, but we've actually been thinking about that quite a bit, and we've, I think, several bits of progress to report on it. I probably won't say an awful lot about that, because I talked about this earlier, but we do have some sort of new results and new ideas to report on that particular one. Now, this is one that we ought to be doing, and I think there's been very little progress in the program on this, but it remains important. How in practice do we verify that GR is the correct theory of gravity under these circumstances? In principle, one can imagine, well, I just see in front of me here some talk on gravitational radiation, so we've got LISA and LIGO and all of that. If they measure the waveforms of coalescing black holes, in principle that will solve the problem, at least it will throw it firmly into the court of the numerical relativist, who will have to calculate these waveforms with exquisite accuracy and do better than they're doing at the moment. And so if that happens, that is probably the best way of this going on. But there ought to be sort of intermediate, less explicit ways of seeing the effects of strong field relativity, some of which are known, and the idea is to make these into sort of firm qualitative tests rather than sort of observations that can be interpreted in these contexts. And that's the challenge. And I say we've not done awfully well on that, I think, but we have something to report. Now, how can we observe relativistic flow directly? Here the great hope is X-ray astronomy, as I mentioned in the answer to Abbe's question. We want to see the flow of gas close to the horizon itself, and then in some ways that's sort of tied a little bit with this, because we're using sort of general relativity to make these interpretations. It would be nice if this could be done in a way that was demonstrably internally consistent. So we have thought a little bit about that, and maybe I'll answer a bit that I don't know. Okay, now another issue, and I will try and say a little more about this, is the role of hydromagnetic theory. It has been, I think, it is now, let me put it like this, it is now clear to almost everybody who works in this business that the major stresses that drive accretion through an accretion disk onto the black hole are essentially magnetic in origin. one's not dealing with fluid turbulence. We are all magnetohydrodynamicists now. And that has had an important change. It means that the most important simulations and calculations that are done are those that rely on hydromagnetic theory, not on fluid turbulence. And whereas you can learn quite a lot from fluid turbulence models and so on, it's really, as long as your gas is at least partially ionized, it almost invariably is, accretion processes are driven by hydromagnetic theory. And that is, in some sense, is now a sort of motherhood statement, but what is not a motherhood statement is how is that implemented in practice. And let me just give you one very simple example. In one limiting case, hydromagnetic theory can the torque can be transported by sort of small tangled magnetic fields, sort of like this, on a very, very small scale. So it, in some sense, it emulates a fluid viscosity on a local scale, or a local turbulent viscosity, although it does have important differences. So in some sense it can be like that. On the other hand, there could be very large, if you imagine this is some sort of magnetic field, then there could be very large loops that are globally transporting energy and angular momentum from one radius to another through a large jump, as it were. That's another limiting case. Those are two quite different views of accretion onto a black hole, and trying to untangle, if you like, the role of the magnetic field is a challenge, and one which I will also try and say a little bit more. And then, sorry, yes? Yes? Yeah, please.
Is there any data about distribution of tangling or curvature in the magnetic field line?
Well, you don't observe them directly. Let me tell you what there is. On the one hand, there are computers. I'll show you John Hawley, who's here, is one of the pioneers of this business, and I'll show you maybe a couple of his simulations, and then you sort of do numerical experiments, and the extent to which you think that these are reproducing the real astrophysical world is, it's up to you how much you believe that they're at that point got the essence correct. The other is in the wonderful laboratory that we have, and again I may try and, I don't have time, it's the Sun. Insofar as hydromagnetic theory is important, the recent space observations of the surface of the Sun by Yoko, Soho and Trace, these triad of spacecraft, are very illuminating, and they show you magnetic fields as they behave in a cosmic environment, not in some stationary axisymmetric applied mathematical calculation. And that's quite different business. Okay, and so one is learning an awful lot about the actual behavior of magnetic field under conditions that are different, but not so different from those that apply around black holes. And that, I think, we ought to be learning a lot more about that. And that's one of the things that we've been trying to do a little bit in this program, is to make the contact actually with space physics, where we have this wonderful local laboratory for showing us how magnetic fields behave in situ. Much better than tokamaks and so on for these purposes. So that's MAC. And then the final thing is to put this into the sort of cosmological context. We've said that every galaxy worth the name has a black hole at its heart, and this then raises the question of what is the role of those massive black holes in the formation of galaxies at the early stages of the universe, and indeed in the evolution of the galaxies. In what is probably the conventional view amongst those who are mostly concerned with galaxy formation, some of whom you've had in programs here at the Institute, this activity in the nuclei of galaxies, the formation of black holes, is very much a sideshow. It's something that happens as an afterthought. It really has nothing to do with the big questions of galaxy formation. When did they form? How did they form? What determines the mass spectrum of galaxies? How does this compare with observations, etc., etc.? In a more radical view that I think many of us are sort of pushing towards, in fact, this formation of the active nucleus may have a lot to do with it. May happen very early on. There's an awful lot of energy released from this relativistically deep potential well, even though there may only be a billion solar masses there as opposed to 10 to the 11 or 10 to the 12 solar masses associated with the galaxy. There's a lot of mass associated with the black hole and a lot of mass energy there because it's so tightly bound, and that may have an awful lot to do with the formation of the galaxy, the formation of the stars around that galaxy, the eventual type or morphology of that galaxy, and indeed the formation of the next galaxy in its environment, the sort of seeding, if you like, of the next perturbation that's going to go on. So again, so I'm sort of presenting this in sort of two extreme views, and you can be almost confident that the true answer lies between those two extremes. But I think the fact that there are two views here is in some sense a development, and several of us have been thinking about that in a sort of semi-quantitative way. Okay, so those are the sort of questions, and that in some sense is what we try to get going on. So, yes, excellent, yes?
Height is the association between million solar mass black holes and the centers of galaxies, in the sense that what percentage of galaxies do we think have such holes, and also do we know there aren't million solar mass holes or not?
Very good question indeed. Thank you. The current situation is that galaxies come in a range of luminosities or equivalently sizes. There's a characteristic luminosity which we call L star, and that measures that's M31 basically. That's an L star galaxy. We're about a half L star roughly. All right. And then the most luminous galaxies are up to about 10 L star, and if we take out their quasars. Now, as far as we can tell, galaxies with luminosities more than about a third or so of L star have black holes in their nuclei. There are some where we haven't found the one or two upper limits, but basically almost all of them have a black hole in their nucleus. It ranges from about a 2.5 million solar masses in the case of our galaxy, the measured ones, to the largest confidently measured black hole mass is in the nucleus of M87 in the Virgo cluster, and that's 3 billion solar masses. So we've got a dynamic range of 1,000 in the black hole masses. And there's a lot of discussion and talk about possible correlations of the masses of those holes with the properties of the galaxy, in particular the bulge mass or bulge luminosity. And so that's already telling you it's got something to do with galaxy formation. So we think that most sort of reasonable galaxies have a black hole in them. Now, if we look at lower mass galaxies, say the Magellanic Cloud, for example, which is about a tenth of L star and less, we don't even know where the nucleus is, let alone where, and there may not be one, let alone where the black hole might be. So there, it could be that none of those galaxies have black holes in them. And we certainly haven't been able to find them in those sorts of galaxies as yet. So that's a very good point. But as far as the big galaxies, the ones you're going to see in distant surveys and so on, those appear to have, almost all of them, to have black holes in them. I won't say all of them, but certainly more than half.
So there was some theory of inflation, for example, that gave you a huge spike in the perturbation spectrum at a point where you would get primordial-like black holes of a million solar mass. Could that play a role in galaxy formation?
It could do. I mean, there is a sort of an even more extreme view that black holes, it's sort of like galaxy formation, so black holes don't actually form in the nuclei of galaxies. They're out there as intergalactic marauders, and they're captured by sort of separately formed galaxies. They spiral into the nuclei, and then they do their active thing there. Now, I think no one in this program would really give that the time of day, but there are, you know, that's a sort of extreme view that some people might have. So in principle, it's possible to do that. The other way that this can be done, and we were actually talking about this at coffee today, is there could be a lot of million solar mass black holes in the halo of our galaxy. It cannot be all of the mass in the halo of our galaxy, or indeed of other galaxies. It cannot be all of it, but it could be a high proportion of it, and we wouldn't know about it. Yeah, we have no good way of finding it astrophysically. In fact, I was arguing today that maybe up to a tenth of the mass of our halo could be in that form, and we wouldn't know about it. We wouldn't expect it to happen. But
would you see some sort of time-dependent lens of the CMB or something?
Well, the CMB is not terribly good because you're like looking at wallpaper. Remember, it's you only see the fluctuations. It's the only thing you can see. A lens doesn't change surface brightness, so that doesn't help a lot. But I mean, a gravitational lensing is one of the best limits one has, but it's not very strong. So there could, in principle, be a lot of black holes and the halos of galaxies. Cosmologically, it's not a very promising thing scenario, but you know, astrophysically, one should be able to set limits, and they're not so good as yet.
Another question.
Excellent. Yes.
Yes. Is there a distinction between ellipticals and spirals in the relationship between the mass of the halo and the
black hole? Well, yes. For ellipticals, they're all, well, what we call all bulge. I mean, essentially, they don't have a disk associated with them, so all of their mass is associated with the bulge, whereas the spirals have much smaller bulges, in particular the late-type spirals like our own galaxy. And the claimed proportionality is that the mass of the whole is at least correlated with the mass of the bulge. And so elliptical, what that means is that the giant ellipticals have big holes in them.
So is it likely that those arose by merger since the ellipticals?
Two things there. It is not accepted by everyone that the giant ellipticals were formed by a series of ellipticals, although they may have been. There are certainly a lot of people who believe that they were formed sort of ab initio. And secondly, probably not in the sense that if you suppose that, just talking extremely, you had a whole lot of spiral galaxies that were going to make an elliptical galaxy, you'd have to have 100 mergers maybe to get a 10 million solar mass black holes into a billion solar mass black hole. And that's more than I think there's any evidence for in the observations. So I think most people would say that the, although mergers almost certainly happen, and in fact I've got a bibliograph about that, mergers almost certainly happen, but they don't have to be the main means of building up the mass. They would be there would be a big black hole in the nucleus of a galaxy, and then it would merge with a nearby spiral that maybe only had 1% of the mass, but still that could be astrophysically interesting and might make a source of gravitational radiation, etc., etc. Okay, so those are all good questions, and I say, it's just, I'm not committed to getting to the end of this presentation, as I'm confident that I will not, and you must tell me when either walk out or something when I'm coming to whatever end conclusions I should be coming to. Okay, so here's one problem that has exercised us. This is going back to this business about what I would call adiabatic accretion. Now, everyone here is familiar with the notion of an accretion disk, where gas spirals around the central object. In this case, it would be a black hole. There are frictional torques there, as I've just told you. We believe very strongly that these are due to hydromagnetic stresses, hydromagnetic forces, and that friction causes angular momentum to be transported. So just like a satellite, if you like, undergoing friction as it spirals into our atmosphere, there will be a loss of angular momentum by the gas, and it will fall out, and angular momentum will be transported radially outwards. Now, generally what has been assumed in accretion disks, quite rightly so, is that as that angular momentum is lost, there is also a loss of energy. And that loss of energy is rapidly converted into radiation, and these disks radiate. That's how we see them. We see them as cataclysmic variables, as Seyfert galaxies, as X-ray binaries, and so on. So we actually see the photons associated with that radiation. So essentially, all the heat that you would associate with that viscosity goes quickly into radiation. And that, in some sense, is the standard case, and no one is arguing with that, because, I mean, people have been making a living for a long time observing the radiation from accreting sources. But it is also, I think, become apparent over the last, well, actually quite a long time, but it's become certainly very popular to think this more recently, that under some circumstances the gas cannot cool. And so you get this viscous effect, viscous torque, you get this transport of angular momentum, but it goes into heat. It doesn't radiate. And that's again like the satellite, like Skylab falling or whatever. It'll go into heat. I mean, there is some radiation, but there isn't very much radiation. Most of it just goes into heat. And there are two circumstances when that can happen. And let me not be too quantitative about this, but just say that basically it can happen when the black hole, as we say, underfed. You give it a relatively small amount of mass, and that turns out that if the torque is quite large, as we believe it should be, the gas is then too tenuous to radiate. Doesn't have to be like this. There are some uncertainties here, but it's a circumstance that can arise in principle, and I think many of us would argue that in practice the observations are telling us that it's arising. And the other term when it can arise is when you actually supply two gas too prodigiously. Under those circumstances, there's no problem in making the photons, no problem in making the radiation, but what happens is the gas, as it sinks towards the black hole, it traps the radiation. There's so much gas there that it scatters the radiation, and it's trying to diffuse out, climb out of its gravitational potential well, but as fast as it's diffusing out, it's advected inwards by the accreting gas. And so it never makes it out. So to all intents and purposes, that gas doesn't radiate either. So you've got a lot of energy created, and it's not able to escape to infinity. And as I say, it's not absolutely clear that that is happening, but it looks seems to be pretty clear that that is happening in a wide variety of accreting systems. And a subject that has, I think, exercised us considerably in this program, is how to describe this. And I'm going to sort of present this in terms of a sort of debate. And I think that's probably not ultimately the right way to think about this. Because I'm confident this is a debate in which there will not be one victor with their hand right up there and somebody with blood on their face on the floor down there, because it won't be quite like that. It'll be more that there are sort of, you know, in some sense, the asymptotically correct view of this thing will contain elements of all views, I suspect. But let me sort of characterize it in this sort of pejorative way just to see what the issue is. The first one is the sort of advection-dominated accretion flow, and my friend and colleague Ramesh Narayan has been a sort of champion of this particular case, as also Shoji Kato, who is here in the audience, and several other people. And here, taking the sort of extreme view, is that the mass flow is conservative. So essentially all the gas that you supply at large radius spirals around the black hole and then goes down the black hole. You don't lose any mass. Associated with this is an assumption which has some plasma physical basis, and a lot of calculations have gone on in doing this, is that the electrons remain as cold as they can be, and they have a thermal distribution. All right, and that's certainly something that one can assume and calculate and switch off all the sort of extraneous processes. So that's one view, and it's the merit of this view is that you're able to make predictions you can go on and calculate, because it makes simple assumptions you're able to go on and calculate. And we usually take this acronym here, they're called ADAF flows, so we're on the other side sort of say this means all data adequately fit. But I mean that as a compliment because they're at least in the position where they can actually produce a model that can be confronted with observations. Alright, so that's a good thing about it. They've made very simple assumptions and pushed it as far as they can. And they've done a good job in terms of contrasting and comparing with the observations. So that's a sort of, you know, that's a strong point in their favour. Now the alternative view, and sort of, as I say, looking at this in sort of from the point of view of extremes, there's I missed this. This is called ADIOS. There should be AD, that's right. Adiabatic inflow-outflow solutions. And here the view was in fact that that most of the mass supplied, in fact, under these circumstances, doesn't get down to the black hole, but is blown away. And if I do this as sort of in the most extreme case, we could look at our galactic center, where we might say that of the 10 to the 22 grams supplied every second at large radius to our galactic center, only 10 to the 17 of those grams actually make it into the black hole across the horizon. And the remainder is blown away from the range of radii between where it is supplied and the size of the hole at about 10 to 11 centimeters or thereabouts. And associated with this view, because obviously under these circumstances you have a much more tenuous plasma in the center, is the view that the electrons are subject to particle acceleration, and so there's, as one sees in other circumstances, sort of copious production, well not so copious, but enough production of relativistic electrons in a way that is hard to quantify, that is able to account for the luminosities and fluxes that are actually observed.
I'll start with that there's 10 to the 22 grams per second being supplied to that outer edge.
Not certain. There certainly could be some, there is, you know, some uncertainty in that value that is exactly 10 to the 22 grams a second. That's the best estimate based on the density at the Bondi radius. and the characteristic temperature there, but there's not, you know, no sort of hydrodynamic models that produce these values. But the sort of disparity is so great that even if that were out by two orders of magnitude, the point of principle would still be there. And so, you know, 10 to the 22 grams, the point about 10 to the 22 grams a second is the luminosity is 10 to the 36 ergs a second. And that means 10 to the 14 ergs per gram. This is radiatively extremely inefficient. And so the point of principle is still there, even if it's much smaller. Lee?
How much of this physics would work very, very early when you just had gaseous disks, these big disks of hydrogen because you have had these kind of accretion processes just without metals?
Oh, yes. Well, of course, metals make it in some sense, under some circumstances, easier for this to happen because metals are rather good at helping you radiate. And so at the right temperature range, having the metals, it facilitates the production of photons. And so you're more likely, in some sense, to get cooling with metals, yes. In practice, you probably build up enough metals to be interesting quite quickly in a cosmological context.
But as people study whether this process might have gone on when there were just big sheets of gas around before gas,
they have actually in one circumstance that I'm actually not a terribly great fan of this work because I think there are other things going on, but one particular study looked at the radiation dominated era and looked at the transport of angular momentum under somewhat adiabatic conditions as a result of radiative viscosity and so on. I actually think there's other things happening there, but at any rate, I mean, the answer to your question is that yes, somebody has thought about that. Okay, so, yes, question.
The second process, okay. I mean, do you have dynamical mechanisms which can really say that, you know, this huge fraction is actually blown away?
Let me come on to that, and I'm not going to say who's right or wrong here, but let's just okay. I think this is the only equation I have here. And it's not much of one. That's the problem. It is quite. What's actually solved in some of these terms is quite sophisticated. I don't want to sell it short on that, but let me just sort of just say what the point is here, and this is perhaps one way of thinking about it. Usually when one tries to do these sort of problems or think about them, these astrophysical flows, the first approximation you make is that things are basically stationary, and then you're relying on conservation laws. I mean, you may express them in a different form, but fundamentally it's mass, momentum, angular momentum and energy that's conserved, and you don't want to lose any of that stuff, and you're just dealing with flow processes. It's just like doing, you know, chemical engineering or whatever. Okay, so basically if we consider the angular momentum flux, the flow of angular momentum, then there's a torque here acting in a disk. So we've got gas orbiting a black hole. We've got a torque here acting on this. And that's sending angular momentum outwards. And then there's gas that's falling inwards with its own specific angular momentum. So GMR to the 1/2 if it's on a Keplerian orbit. All of this can be done relativistically and so on, but we're just dealing with, you know, the most elementary principles. And the point is that these two things scale as r to the 1/2. And so what that means is the two-term scale is r to the 1/2. If this has to be conserved, if we have no means of getting rid of the angular momentum, this has to be conserved. This, except at perhaps at very small radii, this is going to be almost exactly zero. Okay. Similarly, if we consider the energy that's carried through this disk, then this torque does work at the rate g omega, and then there's the mass moving inwards that carries a certain specific energy, called here B, given by this expression here, where that's the potential energy and that's the enthalpy, and this will scale as R minus 1. And again, except at very large radii, perhaps, this will be almost exactly zero. So the issue is the following. If you say that these two are almost exactly zero, and look at sort of intermediate radii and combine these two, then you find that this quantity here, which is in some sense the specific energy of the gas, just in the most simple form, is the product of the angular velocity and the angular momentum. It's a positive number. So because you've got this torque transporting energy outwards, you've got gas here that's being heated, and it's unbound. So, you know, the one view is that this gas is unbound and will blow away. and it must escape, it'll find some way of escaping. The alternative view is, well, that doesn't really matter, particularly if you've got a quasi-spherical flow, because everything's moving in so fast that all that energy, even though it's going into the hole with positive energy, perhaps, it doesn't matter, it'll still all go down the black hole. And one way of trying to think about this a bit more is to, and that people are building up to doing. Okay, there we go. Oh, okay, there we go. All right. Is to try and do numerical simulations. And as John Hawley, who did these simulations, is here, I can't pretend that I did them. And but I can completely fail to describe them correctly. And basically, what there's been a variety of such simulations that have been done by John and his colleagues, one including Jim Stone, who was here over the weekend. And basically, what they have done is looked at hydrodynamical and magnetohydrodynamical simulations of flows around black holes. And I should say these are mock black holes. These are ones that are described by a modified Newtonian potential that looks a bit like a black hole rather than a true Schwarzschild metric. So let me just show you these. You're meant to tell me...
Well, yeah, you have some credit. I guess you have credit at the time the computer wasn't working.
Well, you have to tell me. Well, I will show you these. I've got to do these. So, and you'll see here a comparison in this case between 3D and two-dimensional simulation. So the point is that people, thanks to a lot of hard work, we had gas here that's falling in towards the black hole. These are density contours. And of course, this is much smoother because it's two-dimensional. And you can, by analyzing these flows, you can see what's happening to the gas flow and what's happening to the magnetic fields, how the stress is building up as the consequence of the tangling of the magnetic fields and so on. And so there's a lot of work going on there, and these are tremendously helpful in framing your understanding of how gas flows onto a black hole. So I'll give you one idea, now let's perhaps...
Roger, is this aimed primarily the smaller black hole? You have two classes, but you don't really differentiate...
Scale-free.
This is really scale-free.
This is scale-free.
Uh-huh.
We're not bad, big and small, it's
and
the
most
same.
Of the issues seem like they're scale-free, they don't really differentiate.
There are some things that are scaled, and in particular, as soon as you've got a black body temperature, okay, it's higher for the galactic objects than for the extragalactic objects, but because it goes, think goes to T to the fourth, it's not a big dependence. But this sort of activity is completely scale-free. So here's another way, so the same sort of thing, but seen from above, you've got a view. And what you'll see here is the development of little spiral waves in the density produced in these numerical simulations. And so that just gives you some idea of the sort of work that's going on.
How are you in terms of your outline?
I've got stuff here, as I've warned you, for about another 3 hours. I wasn't intending to go any more than that. Right. Let's make this the last view graph, okay? That's fine. I mean, I said that, and I was prepared to answer questions to go on to other things. But let me make this as it's another issue that has been quite a lot of work done here, particularly by Soji Kato and his students, and also various other people. This Spiegelman, who was here, have been trying to do this. And this is, again, looking at this same simple issue. And this is if you have an adiabatic flow here, with or without the mass loss associated with the winds and so on, but at large radius, that gas almost certainly can cool. And then you have a transition here between a thin accretion disk that is radiating effectively and a thick accretion disk that is not able to radiate. And with the ADAP or ADAP solution or whatever comes out of the equation, there's a real problem here in trying to produce that boundary layer in this region. And it's a sort of boundary layer type problem. And there have been a lot of heroic efforts in trying to provide the correct physical description of that region. And that, again, has been a sort of strong focus of this workshop. And it's been one that, in some sense, it is one of the keys to understanding these adiabatic flows, is to understand the starting conditions, the outer conditions. And it's a sort of one of these characteristic sort of boundary layer type problems, but with many different ingredients. We're not even quite sure yet what the right ingredients are. So that's been another activity that's actually, this one has actually been quite sort of intensive in terms of calculation, because it's produced a, because trying to understand this, you're dealing with the equations of hydrodynamics which start off being nonlinear, and so it's sort of, it's been quite hard to actually model that. Sean?
We expect that there's some number in units of Schwarzschild radii that is the transition radius?
I think other things being equal, it depends on the on how efficient the radiation is. Now, if you believe that the strength of the torque, as computed from these hydromagnetic simulations, is something that is sort of universal, and you scale to a given black hole mass, because the temperatures and so on scale with that black hole mass, then I think you would probably expect a sort of universal transition, radius, and there should be a scaling with the black hole mass and probably not, and the mass accretion rate, excuse me, the mass and the mass accretion rate, but probably not much else. But we don't know that for sure yet.
This is only related to black holes, because this similar structure required by systems neutron star where you work.
Yes. Yeah.
It's an open question. I think this is also connected mainly probably with the structure of the outer disk.
Correct.
That once for some reason
yes.
gamma
right.
whatever beginning by A.
And as Jean-Pierre was telling us this morning, you can really observe, this is one of the things you have some hope of measuring, because as far as the observations are concerned, we're looking at this annular ring here with a hole in the middle, and by looking at the range of temperatures in the optical and the X-ray emission, you can see the size of that, you can measure the size of that hole.
So do we think 2 or 3
Schwarzschild
radii?
Oh, no, we're talking here about, this could be as large as 100,000. It could be. Or basically what happens is in the case of the X-ray binaries, where this phenomenology is best documented, as you increase the mass accretion rate, it's believed that that radius shrinks and essentially becomes the Schwarzschild radius, and you can observe these transitions as you go to smaller and higher mass accretion rate, and that, those are sort of cycles that are seen in the luminosity from these X-ray binaries. So there's a strong contact here with the observations. So, I didn't get very far. I didn't expect to get very far. There's, as I say, several more view graphs and so on. And what I think is most useful is people have to go back to work and all that themselves. I will put a selection of these view graphs on the web, and those who want us to provide a further accounting of what we did, you can look at them there. All right.